I just read Peter Attia's outlived New York Times bestseller, Longevity Expert. Look, it's a big book, kind of long, kind of dense too. Here are three huge tips that I took from the book that I think you could apply to your life right now and live longer. Let's go, Mission Daily. When we were talking about being barefoot, I was at the time reading Outlive, and I've since finished the book. And what we're going to talk about today is some of the things that I've learned, what I liked, and what I didn't like also, because I don't think this book is for everybody. I think the information in it is certainly applicable to many, many people, but I don't think this book is for everybody, and we're going to tell you why today. Mission Daily, Stephanie, how you doing? You are always good. Someone who's trying to do great things. Yeah, you're not as interested in Outlive because I have a decade on you. You see, you have a decade to catch me where I'm at, but I turn 44 next week.
Wow. Yeah, you do have a decade on me. I was listening to an interview today where they were saying, if you're in your 30s, you're at the perfect time to shift the boat. And they're like, it's like the Titanic. It's not that they didn't see the iceberg. They just didn't see it early enough to then move the ship off of that course.
And he makes reference to that as well. And what he actually talks about, the support, what you said is, by the time most people try to think to themselves, hey, I want to live longer, I want to have a better health, he calls it, Dr. Attia calls it a health span, want a better health span, they're usually really late in their lives. And they're more like in their 70s. He talks about them like 7 years old. But by then, whether it's through muscle deterioration, ligaments tightening, whatever it may be, it's almost too late to start. And so it's very similar. He uses the Titanic analogy as well. It's that even if you spot the problem is boats take forever to turn. So you have to turn earlier. Like, you have to turn earlier. It is the only way that he can legitimately say will help you have a better, longer life. If you wait until the end, it's, unlikely.
Yep. So today, what's great is I actually haven't read this book, but you promised me that you were going to bring me three hot tips to help me not die a sad life.
Well,
that you pulled from this book. And I mean, it sounds like this book was a big, well-researched book with a lot of science in it, which is why I was like, can you give me the TLDR? What are the hot takeaways that I need to know? So we're going to go through three of them today, right?
Yeah. So I have a couple, and I think I actually have more than three, but this is my personal review of Outlive. So if you've read any reviews on it, you'll know that Dr. Peter Attia is largely considered, or by many people considered, to be one of the experts in, I think, aging, not dying.
longevity.
He's in that boat, and he himself actively practices what he talks about. And so a good portion of this book he talks about is, his goal is not to help you live forever, it's to have a big health span. And what he defines as health span is the ability to do the things that you most want to do, typically with your body and your brain. So, and I think when you talk to most people and you hear what they think is valuable to them, they will say things that require one or both, right? They want to be able to spend time with their kids. They want to be able to spend time with their grandchildren. They might want to, if play catch or go hiking, go skiing, go doing, some of the things that you enjoy doing, go boating. And we know that as we age, our bodies eventually, they'll get to a state where maybe doing physical things is not a good idea anymore, or you can't. I think about, like, I don't know why my mind skipped to, but like, sometimes when if you've ever been to an amusement park, they'll like list out all the things that you can't have if you want to go on these rides. And so it's like kind of like that. We don't want to be frail. So in this book, he goes through a lot of things he talks a lot about the major killers that will prevent you from living your fullest life: cardiovascular, cancer, Alzheimer's. Like, those are the three big ones that he talks about. What I was definitely hoping for when I read this book was that it'd be a very concrete way to like pull out some information or lifestyle changes that would help you a great deal. But a large portion of the book is a study on studies. It's like, what he talks about is health 3.0, medicine 3.0, which is, it's going to be a little bit of science, it's going to be a little bit of natural ways, all to live longer, right? Stem cells, the different types of tests, cancer screenings, and so on. But it can be, I think, technically challenging. And I definitely think for someone who's maybe not as interested in the science behind certain things, it might be a little hard to read. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Or might be a little bit uninteresting, or they might not understand it. Like, for example, like, could I recite to you what he says about ApoB blood test? No clue. No, no clue. You know what I mean? I couldn't even begin. And there's like chapters of it. But what I could say is, you know, here are some things that he recommended that I have actively been practicing, and I think it's pretty easy to adopt.
How long have you been practicing these things? Because when you got on here, I was like, damn, Albert, looking a little buff. What you doing over there? Working out?
Well, I've always worked out, right? But I haven't done some of the other stuff. But like, so one of the things he talks about very publicly is grip strength, and which is something that I think most people don't think about. But he talks about how grip or lack of grip is one of the biggest detriments to health. And he has studies and facts about how if you break your hip or you get injured, how much shorter your life will become. And the number one cause of a lot of these fractures is, like, let's say a trip and fall incident. If you were to reach your hand out, could you grab onto something and support your own body weight? And so he talks about how most people cannot do that. And so he has this like dead hang test where you're supposed to hang from a bar. A pull-up bar, you don't need to do a pull-up, but you have to keep your feet off the ground. And how long could you hang on to it? And he talks about how you'd be able to hang on for 2 minutes. And I'm like, oh, well, let me try that. You know, I couldn't hang on for at all.
How long was your first attempt?
It was probably right around 30 seconds. Right around 30 seconds.
Probably what I could do too.
Yeah, okay. Maybe I didn't make it to 30. Maybe I fell off and looked up and saw 30. You know, I said, that was 30.
After you spend 20 seconds on the ground being like, damn, that was hard.
Like, my arm sockets are going to rip out. Jeez. So that was eye-opening. I was like, wow, like, I don't have really good grip strength at all. And I've always known that because of farmer's carry. So farmer's carries are, you know, like your brother-in-law, Seth, big country. He can carry stuff, I'm sure, no problem. But like,
yeah,
if I were to carry two kettlebells and just walk with them, like, my hands start to give out pretty quickly. And, you know, even when I see in the camera here, like, I have skinny fingers. Like, my fingers, like, clearly have been used for typing. That's it. Like, they've not done anything hard. And so grip strength was one. So that was interesting.
So, like, tell me about grip strength. Like, I mean, I'm imagining that it's kind of like your feet, your hands, there's fascia that connects every part of your body. And this is something I've been learning in the functional patterns place that I go to here in Austin about, like, all the way from the back of your head, it's connected all the way under your heel. And like, how do you stretch fascia that's interwoven through your whole body and it crosses? So I'm imagining it's something to do with, you know, your hands and that. But did he say why grip strength is indicative of lifespan?
Yeah. So he framed it more so about your ability to support your own weight in the event of a fall, like your ability to grab onto something. And so hanging, doing dead hangs would increase grip strength. But there is, if you remember in our last time we talked, there's a part where he talks about being barefoot and how barefoot creates ankle stability and so on. But there is some truth to what you just said, which is all of our nerves, the areas where we have the highest concentration of nerve endings is like our feet, our fingers, and our sex organs, but you can't really exercise those, I guess.
You could.
You can't. Then. But like, that's like the highest density of stimulus, right? And so I think there's probably a lot to it. And it also, what I talked about in the last episode about how whenever I've gone to these remote places with like pretty rural or agrarian communities, especially coastal towns, the older people there that like work the ports, or they work the ports, you typically, like, because you go out on boats, like they're there, they, to me, they seem so vibrant even at really, really accelerated ages. And I think there's part of it to it, like, they're, you know, they're using their hands, they're using their feet, and I think it's part of it. And when it came to so that was one, that's for sure, like, one tip is like basically hang, that's going to help you out a lot. Probably the most interesting thing was his whole chapter on nutrition and how he basically says that because almost all nutrition studies are flawed, nobody actually knows what you're supposed to eat. He doesn't argue for or against any type of food. I mean, he's kind of pretty much only against sugar, but he's not like, oh, it's better to be vegetarian. It's better to be, you know, a carnivore. He says you do have to eat it. Plenty of protein to be keep your muscles active, because that's a big part of health span. And but the most interesting thing about what he says about eating is you're just supposed to eat less. But that's hard. I mean, most people, people love food.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's why that I was at a Dan Sullivan event this past weekend. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of longevity doctors there. And so I got to hear some very cool cutting edge conversations. But one of the doctors was like, so many people getting on this new weight loss drug. I don't know if you've heard
Ozempic.
Your friends. That one. He's like, even if there are any longer term issues, it's so much better for someone to drop in weight and lower their hunger and reset themselves. Even if there is some kind of long-term issue, it's better to not be overweight because that's the biggest predictor of death and problems. And yes, there's people all over America getting on this at rapid speeds, and America's super obese. So this is probably like one of the best fixes we've seen to help people hopefully reset their weight and their hunger levels, which is essentially just eating less.
So there's definitely chapters about metabolic illness in here, which is pretty interesting stuff. But that was at the core of it. Like, it's better for your brain. It's better for your heart. It's like, we are actually supposed to be hungry. And if you really think about the evolution of societies, you know, prior to farming or even post-farming, it's basically prior to food industrialization, where people could then have food at all times at a grocery store, being hungry was a part of your life. And the further away from modern civilization you were, being hungry was a bigger part of your life, to the point where we were more like animals, probably. Even when we were in like tribal communities, nomadic, whether you go back as far as you want to go back, but as recently as Native Americans, getting food was a big part of your day. And in still like some of the tribal areas of Africa and so on, and in some of the Polynesian islands, like, getting food is like your biggest energy source or better energy expenditure a day. And there's also no guarantee you were going to get something. So my wife likes to joke about back in the day when we were hunter-gatherer society. There's no way the guys came back with a kill every single time.
Yeah.
So she says the women kept everyone alive because the probability of gathering is higher than the probability of getting a kill. Mm-hmm. And so you were probably not eating big meat, big kills. Like, you weren't eating that often. You were eating probably fruits, nuts, whatever could be gathered, whatever you could trap. But typically you only trap small stuff, you know, squirrels. So if you're thinking about like a feeding a whole family or a community of a nomadic tribe, you just weren't eating that much. And so that was it's a big summary for me, but like, we're basically always supposed to feel hungry. Like, that is a good sign of cellular and metabolic health, is that your body, when you are hungry, I'm not going to recite all the science behind it, but he's basically saying the cells are regenerating faster and basically kind of getting rid of bad cells, because what is cancer? Cancer is the growth of malignant cells. It's your body doesn't know the difference between creating a bad cell and a malignant cell, and it starts creating cells that you shouldn't have. And that's what cancer is, right? And it metastasizes to other parts of your body, and this becomes a serious problem. So that was, I think I'd always read, but I had never read so much evidence that suggests, like, you're basically not supposed to eat food.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm usually not too big on blanket statements, but this is actually one that I think, as a blanket statement, it will work for most people in America, at least, of you just don't need to eat as much and be hungry. It's okay to be hungry.
Yeah, he calls it time restrict. So you'll hear intermittent fasting, but he says even then that's a bad term for it. The reason why he says it's a bad term for it, because most of the metabolic changes don't occur for like at least 18 hours. And you're probably better off going like a day without eating, which I was like, I don't know if I could do that. That seems pretty tough.
Yeah. Some of my friends have been going 72 hours and they do it once a year.
Was that just 2.5 days?
Yeah, just with like water and maybe. And I know they do have to put, there's certain things you need to do, like putting electrolytes and certain things in the waters. And I don't know fully, but I'm like, 72 hours, damn, they just like took it to a whole new level. Outside of 18 hours, no, fuck this, I'm going days. And when you think about it, I mean, tribes all over the world do this. You go to Sundance, you go to Moondance. Like, this is what they do. They fast for many days. So I think it's just more abnormal in America to be like, yeah, for us to be like, what, 3 days?
Because we have abundance of food.
Yeah.
We have food abundance, right? And so, like, reading that, so I started thinking to myself, so he calls it time-restricted eating. It's basically saying, like, when he works with people, he says the first thing you should do is just cut the windows of time that you can eat into smaller windows.
Yeah.
Because in general, you just can't eat that much. That's the idea. But if you're a big eater, what I've been trying to do is like, because there's a lot of people that, and I feel like this happens more in men than women, but there's a lot of people who they don't really actually feel like they ate unless they feel full or stuffed almost.
Yeah.
And so like one of the records is like, okay, just eat, instead of eating one meal, try to eat two meals at one time and then do your best to not eat again or not eat another meal again. Eat only good stuff like fruits, vegetables, that's fine, but don't actually have like a meal. So I've been eating like one to two meals a day, and that's, my weight's dropped. I definitely have gotten stronger because just yesterday we did a workout where there's toes to bar in the CrossFit workout. And typically in toes to bar, for those who are not familiar, you have to hang. So you have to have good hand strength, and it's exactly as it sounds. You're going to lift your toes and kick it above your head and kick the bar. And usually I have to do them one at a time. Like I do one, I need a break. Mm-hmm. Two, I need a break. Three, I need a break. But yesterday was the first time ever I strung nine together. I've never done that before. So I just boom, one, two, three. And I was like, wow, this is kind of cool. So it's kind of cool seeing like the impact. And then also so the workout yesterday was run half a mile, six rounds of nine toes to bar, 15 wall ball shots, and then run half a mile again. So on the first half mile, I told myself, well, I'll go easy because I know toes to bar kill me. But I still did it in 4 minutes, which is a lot faster than my normal like hard pace. And I was jogging. And so I was like, oh, this is kind of cool. Like, and I'm 44. So like to see it working like super fast, like that was kind of cool.
Wow. Yeah. So you're hanging more or doing things to promote better grip strength and then losing
for sure
at the same time.
Yeah. I'm not actively trying to lose weight. I'm actively trying to eat less. Like that's like getting used to being hungry is so like I've like reframed my mind. Don't say I'm not as good as you. Not as good as you.
As good as me.
Well, I think you can reframe your mind better than me. But what I tell myself when I'm hungry is that you're not hungry, is you're fighting cancer right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually tell my kids that, fighting cancer right now. It's like, are you hungry, Dad? And, yeah.
So, fighting cancer. I love that. I'm fighting cancer right now.
I'm fighting right now.
Yeah. I mean, I do think doing mind tricks like that, I know I've said this so many different times, but when you work with your mind and tell yourself a story that many times, you're going to believe it. And then things will start to not feel as necessary, like whether it be food. I mean, I did this. I think I told you how I did it with sugar back when I was like 21. I wanted to stop sugar. And did I ever tell you this?
I don't think I've heard this exactly. But I know you don't eat that many sweets. I do know that.
Yeah. So it all started back when I was working at Fannie Mae. I was drinking tons of coffee. I was always putting tons of sugar and the sugary creamers and all this in it. And then I realized, basically, I'm not even drinking coffee. I'm just drinking like sugary things. And then it would activate more of a sweet tooth. And then I would want more things. And then I'd get home and I'd want something. And that it was just getting out of control. And I forget what I read about like the impact of sugar and Alzheimer's and all that. And so I was like, I want to cut back a lot on this. And I want to retrain my taste buds to get back to the basics. And so for 21 days, I was pulling back on sugar. But every time I would want it, I would tell myself, I don't like that. That doesn't taste good. And I would do it so many times.
But that's a lie to yourself.
Yeah, you can lie to yourself. People lie to themselves every day. People literally are just walking around this world lying to themselves. Why not lie to yourself in a way that's going to help your future?
Yeah,
it works.
When ugly people look in the mirror, like, oh, I look good. Like, no, you do not.
Well, hey, you know what? They might need to do that too. But I do think like you are the stories that you tell yourself. You get to decide how you're going to feel about something. And if you tell yourself something so many times, it will become a pattern or a thought of yours. And I'm telling you, when I taste sugar now, and didn't take very long, I'd say a month. And then after I started tasting it, it just didn't taste like it used to. One was retraining my taste buds probably, but I just didn't have that craving, because when things would come around of like, oh, here's dessert or whatever, my first thought was like, well, I don't really like things like that. Without even me trying, I'd be like, I don't really like stuff like that. And is this worth it? Is this good quality? Or is it just sugary, like things that I don't like anymore?
I know exactly what you're saying, because if you meet, so I'll use my mom, for example. My mom obviously grew up in Taiwan, and she moved to America until she was in her mid-20s, around that time. But I remember being young and her not liking American desserts. I was like, why is that? Like, what do you mean you don't like this? This tastes great. But, and then I would eat like Taiwanese desserts, and like Taiwanese desserts, like not very sweet. They're just not sweet relative to American desserts. It's not sweet at all. Like,
Taiwanese desserts. I used to go to like a Thai bakery in Palo Alto. And like, I like that and not overly sweet just to be sweet.
Yeah, yeah. Or for Thailand, like, yeah, mango sticky rice is like a good, is like a treat, you know, dessert, but like the sweetened with mango and a little bit of condensed milk, not like pounds of sugar on it. But yeah, I've definitely been around enough immigrants to know that it is an acquired taste. So if you can acquire it, you could lose it. And that's what it sounds like you did. You lost it.
Yeah, yeah. I've lost it. Yeah. I mean, and I've also done it with pain before too, when I was in a lot of pain. And the things I would tell myself is like, there's literally people suffering from cancer and terrible things. Shut the fuck up, Stephanie. Like, I would tell myself that, like, don't be a little bitch about, you know, cramps or whatever it is. And the second I would think that kind of stuff of like, this is not that bad. Like, come on. It would change instantly. And so that was when I started realizing, like, your mind is so powerful. And I don't think we value that enough of like, what can we change if we tell ourselves a different story and remind ourselves, you know, to maybe look out of our scenario, whether it be whatever it might be, whether it's something that you're addicted to sugar wise, alcohol, like you can retrain your brain. It just takes 21 days normally, but you can do it.
Yeah. So I chose my message more like from, Simon Sinek's like start with the why, like why do I feel hungry right now? But it's in the same line that you're talking about, which is trying to tell myself like, oh, this is why I'm choosing to be hungry. It's like it because I agree, like if you were to just think to yourself my options are to be hungry or not hungry, then it's easier. You don't have a reason to be hungry, right? It's like, oh well, then I'll just eat. Right? But now it's like, okay, it's game time, baby. Like right now, my cells are I'm turning out my bad cells. It's like, that's kind of like, so how long can I turn out bad cells before I cave to eating something? So so I've really only been eating twice a day. So probably around four cups of food. I generally don't eat too much junk food. So four cups of food, typically with a high vegetable concentration diet, it's almost always about 2,000 or less calories. Excuse me, eight cups of food a day. But
I mean, I think that you're on the right track for what your body needs. I will say earlier when you said Peter says that, you know, no one really knows what they're supposed to eat, I do think that we are in a place now where we do kind of know what each person should have, but it's super personalized and it depends on your DNA, your ancestry, like all of that things. It depends on your age. I mean, I was hearing from this expert this past weekend where he's like, over 50, you really need to cut back on meat because meat, all red meat, turns on some kind of aging gene in you. It just activates it. It doesn't do it when you're younger, but once you get past 50, it activates it, which makes sense. I'm like, most people who are older that I'm around who are more intuitively listening, like, what should I eat? Most of them pull back on meat a lot and they're much more like lighter, less food, more vegetables. And so I think that we are in a place now with all the data, with all the AI coming out in the health space, with all the knowledge we have, we do know what people should be eating. It's still just taking time to get to the mass public, but it's a personalized approach and every person's very different.
I thought that was very interesting that he doesn't really take a position on food composition, like what you're supposed to be. He does talk about protein specifically as a nutrient, but he doesn't, you know, he doesn't say like, hey, a plant-based diet, a meat diet, a Mediterranean diet, there's a lot of different like keto diet. Like his reasoning is that most studies of diets are actually quite flawed. And a lot of them are based on self-reported information. So like, you know, they don't actually monitor or strictly monitor someone's dietary habits. It'll be more like, oh, how often did you eat meat this last month? And people just recite it. And so he goes through and cites all these studies that when you dive into the research, remember I said like a lot of scientific research, for those who have ever read science-based papers, the first is going to give you an intro. The whole middle is how they conducted the study. And then there's usually a couple conclusions at the end. So the reason why they do that is because they want to show you definitively that what they've come to a conclusion is as accurate as it can be. And so he was more debunking all these studies than he does taking a side of what to eat. So he kind of favors in his book time restriction as well as not eating much over saying like, oh, you should eat more broccoli, you should eat more berries. But I think based on my observational skills and just blue zones, I lean towards what you just said, which is most of the societies where they live the longest, healthiest lives, they don't eat a lot of meat. They don't, and they definitely don't eat sugar.
Yeah. But I think at certain ages, like I think it maybe could be fine. I mean, that's where I'm like, every person's so different. I mean, you remember in a previous episode where I talked about how the things I shouldn't be eating are kale and like dark.
Oh, yeah. You had that personalized study. Yeah.
Yeah. Where it looked at my 23andMe and then a couple other things as well. And then she did muscle testing. But the things she came back with were a lot of dark green vegetables, which I grew up in a family where it's like, you've got to eat all, you know, leafy greens. And that's just what I was used to.
Yeah.
And here comes this doctor who I met with who's like, no, actually, your DNA cannot process that. And it's going like anything with high oxidatives, I think, is oxalates. High oxalates.
Oxalates.
Yeah. So anything that has high oxalates, my DNA does not do well with. So I'm like, there's no such thing as just a diet of that. I mean, I think there is like a low oxalate diet, but I don't think diets fit for people because it's really so specific of like these things might impact you negatively. These things will give you inflammation. They're going to make you feel like congested.
Well, there's definitely a high. So like this, and this is where this is really just a modern problem, right? Is like did people have dietary deficiencies prior to the grocery store? I don't know if we did, because you could obviously only eat what was near you. You know what I mean? Like if you grew up in a region, let's say, I mean, you look pretty northern to me. I don't know. But leafy greens are typically grown in warmer climates. So it would have made sense that you're more like meat, potatoes, root vegetables, carrots, stuff like that, because that's probably what was around you. So for a handful of generations, let's say.
Yeah. I mean, and that's what's interesting is because so many people aren't in the space of where their family or their lineage like grew up at, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's where I think it's interesting to do some of these, you know, very personalized tests around diet just to see like, what would it show you? Because I don't actually know where most of my family grew up. I don't know. Like, where did my dad's side grow up? Where did my mom's side go up? Which part is influencing how I should be eating? And that's why this test looking at my DNA was the most helpful. Yeah, I know that many other countries who have a much higher focus on nutrition do just this. It's just not in the U.S. because the U.S. doesn't focus on nutrition. The doctors don't learn nutrition.
That's correct.
So they don't know any of this stuff. But like other countries are looking at people's DNA to say, okay, here's a roundabout diet that could work for you. Here's maybe medicines that will work for you, or these ones won't because of your DNA. This one won't even work on you. So we're not going to go there. So I think there are other places that show a very personalized approach. It's just not here yet. And so we're still in the phase of how do we assemble, you know, our own care team, our own research to figure out what's best for us. But I still think it's coming and I'm bullish on it.
I don't doubt it. I mean, I'm doing it just through observational. There is clearly certain regions, and it just could possibly be that that region, based on its like flora and fauna or whatever, makes it so that you have to, of course, you have to eat that way, but there is certainly I think there's enough anecdotal ancillary evidence that suggests certain specific diets are substantially better than others for us. And if you can personalize it, because that's the other thing is like modern grocery store has enabled us to eat whatever, right? No matter where it's grown. So knowing which one you're supposed to or are optimal for you, I think is good. I think to like how people react to chilies, do you know what I mean? Like, so obviously, take a look at my skin. I'm from closer to the equator. Like when I eat chilies, no impact. I enjoy it. Mm-hmm. I think it tastes good. And then my wife, she's Scottish. If she eats a chili pepper, like she turns red, skin starts changing colors. Like it's like, I don't know if it's bad for her, but like, her body is reacting 100%. You know what I mean? Like without a doubt.
Yep. I mean, yeah, that right there shows like she probably shouldn't be eating it. Like her body's like, stop doing that to me.
Yeah, like don't put spicy food in me. Whereas obviously from people in the equator, they're like, that's fine. So who knows? So that was a good takeaway, I thought, is you know, we're just supposed to be hungry. Like you're not actually supposed to feel full, which I think most people, if they hear that, they're like, what do you mean? It's like, you don't need to be full. Like you're supposed to actually always be a little bit hungry, which it's like, wow. The third thing that I took away from the book that I thought was really good is, so he talks about the ability to, or your body's ability, what is it going to do with extra calories? Of course, it turns extra calories into fat, stores of energy. But he talks about how there's two types of people that store fat. Some people store it in the skin. So people who store fat above the muscle on the skin tend to show outwardly that they're chubby, out of shape, whatever you want to say. But then there's a subclass of people, he says, that store it internally in your organs. And these are the ones that die, like, to the observational eye, how could he get a heart attack? And he says these people are at the biggest risk because they have no clue they're at risk. And so he dedicates a tremendous amount of time to talking about getting scanned earlier. I think we've all heard of cancer screening earlier. So he's a big proponent of colonoscopy. Most people aren't recommended for colonoscopy until they're 45. He's like, why are we waiting until 45? You should get a baseline immediately. And he talks a lot about the different scans, such as, did you know this? There's blood clots. So you can have like your blood, you can scan for blood clots. You can scan for fat buildup in your atherosclerosis or whatever in your veins. Apparently when you have fat buildups in your blood vessels, they actually don't go away. They're there forever. You're not able to just get rid of them. That's what like angioplasties and stuff are for. And so what happens is if you can eat better, you'll of course build less fat up on it. And what happens is imagine there's a bump in your, like a speed bump, right? Mm-hmm. If it gets like chunky and thick, then blood is rushing up. Like I'm going to use my petrified wood. It's not a turd, people. It's petrified wood.
Sure.
So if this is a tunnel, right? Like this is blocked, but it's like, the blood will push it. If it pushes it loose, now you have particles. It can be stroke, heart attack, and so on. And it's like, dang. But if your blood health, it like smooths over. And if it smooths over, then blood can continue to flow. And so in both the chapter about cardiovascular health and then the chapter about cancer, he talks about how modern testing and screening is getting really exceptionally good.
Yeah.
I can't confirm or deny like which doctors or facilities we should go to, but I have started looking into getting scans. And like a big problem to these scans is these scans aren't covered by insurance because they're totally elective.
Yeah.
So you can end up paying like $2,000 or whatever, maybe
because
more.
Insurance, they don't care about preventative. So they don't, yeah. I mean, but so, I will actually say there are insurance companies coming out now that I'm hearing of that are all about preventative and doing these scans, and then you get insurance based off your health. So exciting shift.
Yeah, I would love it if insurance like would give you like a rebate on your actual, like let's say health plan, if you paid for this up front. That would be a fair trade.
Yeah, so I know of one. So for a diagnostic company, actually one of my friends went down and did this. I think they have a place in Dallas. I think they have one, a couple spots around the U.S., but it's called Life Force, and you go there and you get a full body diagnostic scan. Mm-hmm. And this one, hearing the results of people going in there thinking that they're pretty good and they're days away from having a stroke or seeing certain, you know, calcifications in, I don't know, their heart. I mean, I'm not a doctor, but hearing what they're able to identify. And if you can identify it, you can prevent it. You can stop it. You can,
correct,
you know, not have a stroke. And it's, to me, amazing that we have these abilities now. So Life Force is one of them that I heard of. I know it is kind of expensive, but I'm like, if you could have a full scan once a year, you budget for that to be like, what's going on? Or even once every couple of years. I mean, that is something I want to like start budgeting for in my life to be able to just know what's going on in there. And then what can I do to course correct like the Titanic ship? Like, what can I do to start helping? And then on top of Life Force, which I'm sure there's many other companies out there. That's just the one I know of. Life Force has an insurance division too. Mm. So Albert, I actually wanted to look this up for our company just to see like if we could even get it. But they allow you to get, you know, you get the diagnostic and then you get insurance for employees based off of their composition of health. And to me, that is a model that I'm like, that sounds also more fun. And it like gamifies the experience of like, how do I get my premiums down? How do I, you know, what are the pieces I need to work on? And they even said that, you know, a lot of times not a lot of times. Some people will go in there and maybe they've been told before by a doctor that they have, calcification, like a hardening maybe in their arteries or something like that. And with this machine, you can go in there, and if you can prove that actually these pieces are calcified to a point where they're not even impacting this person, they've been living with this for 30 years, it's actually fine. And it's these things you should look at instead. Like, the precision of diagnostics that they have is so exciting. And I'm like, we're in a whole new world right now that I think more people, if they can look into this and prepare for this wave, like, this is what AI is bringing
well,
to
that's,
like this.
That's the other thing is, like, even if you got an MRI or a radiology scan or whatever you got, like an MRI scan, ultrasound, sonogram, like whatever, it doesn't matter. You really are, or we are really relying on the opinion of one person. Think about that. The old way is you rely on the opinion of one doctor, and they might be the best doctor on earth, but what they observe in your scan, and we relied completely on their ability to say, yes, you are in danger possibly of having cancer. Yes, you are in danger of possibly having a heart attack, or maybe you're not. So what I extrapolated from the book is like, okay, that's relying on the human's eyeball. Like, it's literally, you're relying on one person's eyeball. And and so it does talk about how modern scanning machines are getting exceptionally good. It is going to be evaluated by computers for sure. And so its ability to catch something smaller, because this is just sheer size. Like, can I see something or not see something? If it can catch anything, and I think we all know, he talks about in the book, but I think we all agree, anything that is caught earlier is easier to fix than later, right? Was it easier to find the loose screw on the Alaska Airlines plane or fix the giant hole after it blew off mid-flight?
Clearly for them, it's easier to fix a giant hole.
You should have fixed the screw.
Tell him. Tweet that to him. That's advice right there. I'm trying to look for.
That's the whole point. Don't wait until like the bad thing happens. And so he talks about like, right, it's hard to course correct later down the path. And he talks about how, hey, a lot of times the number one thing that gets people to start working out is after they have a heart attack. It's like, oh, I got a heart attack. Now maybe I should do something about it. But by then you might have muscle loss. You might be at an age. Because he talks about building muscle and like how you don't really build muscle after a certain age. You just try not to lose it. So you don't have a good base. Well, you're really screwed. You're really screwed. Like, you're 7 years old. You have no muscle. Like, you really can't build much.
Yeah. So, but where technology is going, you never know.
Straight up new roids, man.
Yeah.
But human growth hormone, like, yeah, he talks about hormone therapies. He talks about these types of things. But those are the three things that I pulled out of the book that I tried to start immediately doing, because I think we all can hang for sure, pull up bar, kettlebells, whatever. Because if you can't hang your whole body, you got to hold something heavy. So hanging or improving grip strength was the first thing. The next thing was, hey, you should just eat way less and be hungry more often. Like, you feel fine if you want to eat like that one satisfying meal a day in general. And I've noticed that, like, you cannot eat enough. Like, you can't eat enough calories off one meal to gain weight. Like, it's really hard to eat a 2,500 calorie meal.
Yeah.
Like, and one of the other things that I've started noticing is like the signal from your brain or your stomach, excuse me, to your brain that says I'm full.
Mm-hmm.
It trips faster when you've been hungrier longer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, it definitely trips after, like, for me, like 2.5-3 cups of food, it'll be like, you're full.
Yeah.
Or like, dang, I never would have been full before on that.
Yeah.
And then take advantage of these modern scans. So this is where it's challenging for me, because I started doing some Google searching, and for sure, there's a lot more companies than I realized that offer this type of service, but I don't know which one is good. So I don't know which one's good yet, but I am 40. I turn 44 next year. I will be getting, unfortunately for me, a colonoscopy.
It's good.
Well, it's got to get done, right? And I think that's another thing that I've always known about in the past, and I'll say especially for men, like, a lot of men don't want to hear bad news. It's really weird. It's like they'd rather just not hear that this is a problem. It's like, or experience embarrassment or whatever. It's like that's why they don't get prostate exams or colonoscopies.
Yeah.
It's like the number one reason. It's like they think it's embarrassing. It's like, these are professional doctors. Like, this is what they do. Like, they, you're no weirder to them than any of the hundreds of people that they're going to see in the next month, you know?
Yeah.
So get your scans.
Get your scans. I love it. All right. Well, this was awesome. I think for me, I'm like walking away with, I'm going to improve my grip strength. I still need to work up my muscle and get some strength training going even more to be able to build my base. I'm already good at probably not eating too much anyways, so that one's good. And time-restricted feeding, I've actually gotten better at that, mainly not eating late at night. That was something that I used to do. But then after I heard about how it impacts your sleep and how it sends your body into a whole, like, you know, time to...
How you done? What did you experience after you changed that habit?
I do sleep a lot better. I did two things. I stopped eating past 6:30, if possible, because I wake up early and I eat. So I was like, I cannot go till 8, 9, 10 o'clock at night eating snacks and like a bowl of cereal and whatever. So I stopped doing that. And then I also made sure that if I'm ever having a glass of wine, I don't have it past 7 p.m. Because that was something that messed with my sleep a lot too. And I knew it. And when I heard the science behind why it's messing with your sleep and then why food's messing with your sleep, I'm like, okay, I just need to stop most things probably like 5:30 and 6 and just be done for the night. Yeah. And it has been very, very helpful, even just the food perspective, but also any wine or anything. Like, it's been very helpful in my sleep to get good sleep. Because then what I would notice is when the kids would come and wake me up at 1 or 2 in the morning sometimes, I would be so groggy. And as a mom, like, most people be like, that's probably normal. But when I don't have food late at night, my body can fall into a deeper sleep. Yeah. And I was able to get up and not be as like agitated. I was kind of like, okay, I've got you. I'm going to put you back to sleep. But it didn't feel like I was so out of it. Like I had never slept in the first place, you know? But now it's like I get my deep sleep, even if it's just an hour. And I get woken up after an hour and I'm like, okay. Like it feels better now than it would have when I was eating late at night and my body was like staying awake. So.
Yeah, I also stopped eating late. So right now, the way I'm eating currently is around 11. If I'm at home around 11, I usually will cook pretty big lunch. Like I just had some broccoli, cooked in a homemade peanut sauce, not like a store jar peanut sauce, mm-hmm. like actual crust peanuts, a little bit of soy, some onion, garlic, rice. Look at my eyes. Of course, I eat rice with every meal. So then I ate like two bowls of that. So that's probably like 3.5 cups, and then later tonight I'll probably eat just like oatmeal and fruit. That's it, and that'll be my day of eating, and that'll happen around 5. So then I'll go 5 till 11.
I don't
know, something like that.
That's good. We need to do a check back in a month and then track your progress, and we should go and figure out what tests, like diagnostic tests, we want to take.
Oh yeah, that'd be fun. I'll pick some places out in the Raleigh area my area is known for good medicine, just like Austin is. So I trust that one of these is a good one. It's just a matter of picking the right one.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, you find one, I'll find one. We'll have a future episode where we go through our results and see what we need to do.
Yeah, yeah. I'm definitely nervous to find my results, but it's necessary. It's like our Alaska Airlines plane analogy is actually quite perfect. It's like you might have a screw loose, but...
Yeah.
Better to find it and fix it than to wait for the door to blow off.
Yeah, let's not let your door blow off. So,
yeah, yeah.
Do that.
Yeah, let's find it and fix it now, right? It's always a better idea than finding it later when it's a serious problem.
There you have it. All right, well, thanks for diving into that humongous book and bringing back your takeaways. And if you're loving this show, please make sure you rate and review it and let us know what you think. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be right back.